everyone. Pleased that you could all make this on a Monday morning in almost August. I think we have a really interesting event this morning. ITIF has started to dip its toe into the whole innovation in the environment and carbon and green space in the last few months. We held an event at the New Democratic Retreat, Caucus Retreat. We did help do an event on the Hill recently with Brookings and the Breakthrough Institute. There's a piece out there also for that we recently wrote in Business Week. And the reason we've done that is because we think that the current thinking about the debate on climate change is, shall we say, too limited, and ultimately, unless we change how we're thinking about climate change, we're not really going to solve the problem. And I think where we are today is, luckily, we're at a point where we've moved away from the debate, which was relatively fruitless debate about whether this was real, and now we're of acceptance that this is real. But the real question is not so much now is it real, but what do you do about it? And unfortunately, the consensus and sort of the mind share in Washington has coalesced around this answer that what you do about it is you do cap and trade, and that through the magic of the marketplace that somehow this will lead to the solutions that we need. And I think what we'll hear today is that that's a fundamentally too limited a view, and that what we need is innovation policy. Not just innovation, but innovation policy. The reason why I think we're not going to get where we need to go is a couple of things. One is, you have to get to the answer we need. At minimum, we need a global, we need efficiencies of 80%, 80% more efficient use of all of the things we do to emit carbon. So each of us has to emit 80% less carbon as a person by 2050 if we're going to cut carbon emissions globally by 50%, controlling for population increase and per capita income growth. You're not going to get there by driving a plug-in hybrid or putting complex fluorescent light bulbs in there. That's just not going to get you there. So you have to have pretty radical change. Well, how are you going to get that radical change to create a new green energy system? The sort of current view is, well, we'll get there by this cap and trade, and we'll take these emissions out. And there's two theories around that. One is that that's going to lead to higher prices, which will then lead to innovation. Let me suggest that I don't believe that's, it will lead to higher prices. It's not going to lead to innovation. Case in point is the Netherlands. I was just over there. They have a $400 a ton price on carbon, i.e. their really high gas tax. I think under Markey, I read that we would be getting, what, a $5 to $15 a ton price on carbon. So the Netherlands have a $400 a ton price on carbon with their $4 or $3 a gallon gas tax, whatever it is. And yet, there are no electric cars in the Netherlands. What they have is smaller cars, no question about that. And they have more people taking transit and riding their bikes. There's no question about that. That is not enough to get you to where you need to get. You have to have electric cars or some sort of non-gasoline burning cars. So price isn't going to get us there. Then the other big problem that no one seems to want to talk about is, well, it's fine for us to do this, but we're a small portion of the global economy. What about China? What about India? What about Russia? Well, the view there is that we'll just sort of force them to do this. And good luck with that. That, I think, is going to be a very tough political sell. It seems to me the only answer to get a country like India and China to embrace this is to make it, as the Godfather said, an offer they can't refuse. So in other words, make the technology so compelling and actually as cheap as the current technology, if not cheaper, and that's when you're going to see global adoption of the technology, not through some global political pressure that I frankly don't think is going to work. So with that as a context, and sort of setting the case for why we need innovation, the real question then is how do we do that? And there are lots and lots of different tools and aspects of innovation policy in this space, and that's really what our speakers are going to talk about today, is how do you structure that green innovation revolution that we have to have. We're going to start with Bill von Villian as the main speaker. For those of you who don't know Bill, Bill, when he was on the Senate working for Joe Lieberman, knew more than any other Senate staffer, at least that I knew, I think this is probably true in general, on innovation policy. He was the guru.
Probably that's not saying much, Rob. That's the only thing.
Well, the bar is low, I will admit that. But still in all, Bill was the expert on the Hill on innovation policy and a real leader on this issue when he was with Senator Joe Lieberman for, I think, 17 years and finally as legislative director. He left in 2006, January, and he has now, since then, been the director of MIT's Government Relations Office, where he focuses on a whole set of issues around innovation and innovation policy. Bill also serves on the Board of Sciences and Science Education at the National Academy. He's written numerous articles. He won the IEEE Distinguished Public Service Award in 2007. And most relevant for this event, he is the author with Professor Charles Weiss at Georgetown of a book that just came out in April called Structuring an Energy Technology Revolution. If you haven't read it, you should read it. I read the galley, so I assume it's still a compact book. It's a nice, compact, easy-to-read book, so it's definitely worth getting. And it really lays out in very, very good detail how do you get here, how do you get to where we need to go. I think most importantly, Bill has a Master's of Divinity from Yale Divinity School, so he can talk about the religious aspects of clean technology.
We're going to need divine guidance before this is over.
Exactly. You can show us the way. After Bill will be Dan Sarewitz. Dan, again, one of the best thinkers, I think, on innovation policy. I knew Dan back when he was on Capitol Hill, when I was at OTA. In the late 80s, he was a consultant that worked for George Brown, who, if you've been in Washington long, you remember George Brown, probably one of the best members of Congress on this issue of innovation in a long, long time. Dan was with the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. He's actually co-director of the Consortium for Science Policy and Outcomes at Arizona State University, although he's now spends his time for the last year here in Washington. If you don't know that center, it's a pretty interesting center that really tries to look at this nexus between academic research on science policy and politics and policy. He's written several books. His most recent book is Living with the Genie, Essays on Technology and the Quest for Human Mastery. Another book, Prediction Science, Decision Making, the Future of Nature. And unfortunately, I have to admit, I've only read one of Dan's books. I've read Frontiers of Illusion, Science, Technology, and the Politics Project Progress, which was an excellent book I encourage you to look at. Dan also is, I think, the only scientist up here today. He has a PhD in geological sciences from Cornell. So with that, we'll start with Bill. If you want to come up here. And we will adjourn precisely at 10:30, and we should have time for questions.
You know, I thought I'd run through a few basic, you know, data points as kind of a backdrop on the R&D front, and then, you know, think about innovation policy, sort of following that, and then a little political context, what's going on politically on these issues. So we'll sort of hit these three points as we go through here. Just very briefly, federal spending on R&D for new energy technology is probably about half of what it was at a high point in 1980. Once in that time period, it was 10% of total US R&D. It's now down to about 2%. US investment in energy R&D is down about 58% approximately between 1980 and 2005. The largest pharmaceutical in the United States spends more than twice what the federal government did in 2007 on new energy technology R&D. The private sector story is similar. This is what these lines look like, public and private. Interestingly, the relationship of federal R&D spending to the price of oil is profound. And every time we have a spike in the price of oil, we throw some R&D money at it. Every time it goes down, we withdraw from the field. This is a roller coaster, and as those in this room know, you can't fund a revolution on a roller coaster. This is not just a U.S. issue. This is a worldwide issue. These are IEA numbers of the leading economies, OECD economies, investing in energy. There's a similar decline in R&D spending. If you're an innovating industry, you know, you're bringing on new technologies, what kind of percentage of R&D, you know, do you spend? You know, semiconductors, 16% of annual revenues on R&D, pharmaceuticals, 18%, biotech, 39%. Of course, there's a lot of biotechs that don't have any revenue, which is partly an explanation for that high number. But, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20% or 10 and 20% is kind of in range if you're bringing on a lot of technology. Even established industries, electronics industry, 8%. Auto industry until this past year, 3%. On the energy private sector side, it's less than 1%. Again, not for total R&D, but for kind of new energy technologies. So we've got a huge investment problem on the innovations that we're going to need to get through this process. Lots of studies out there have said we ought to multiply the R&D investment levels anywhere from twice to 10 times. When the federal government does a big technology push, you know, what does that look like? Well, a couple of examples. The Apollo program, and this is both R&D and implementation, the Apollo program that we're celebrating today, $185 billion over 9 years, the Carter-Reagan defense buildup, $445 billion over 8, doubling NIH, $138 over 5, and what is by far our largest current technology program, ballistic missile defense, $145 billion over the first 6 years, and due to go up to about $200 billion. So that's the kind of scale when the feds want to do a big technology investment that they spend at. Now, those are not the right organizational models, right? And we'll talk about that. But that gives us a scale yardstick. You know, is this money kind of just tossed away, or do we get something for this? Long-standing literature on the return on federal R&D investment indicates that the returns are actually quite high. And they may be particularly high in energy because you get, you know, savings not only by bringing a new technology into the economy with corresponding productivity gains, but you get some very direct cost savings potentially as well. So if there is a very high rate of return, that's also very suggestive, economists tell us, of systematic underinvestment. What's this task going to take? Well, last summer, the IEA, the International Energy Agency, which is the OECD's analytical arm on energy R&D and energy policy and energy supply and demand data, highly respected organization, they put out a report that indicated that if we stabilize CO2 at current levels, you know, 2005 levels, by 2050, that would be, in both R&D and implementation, about a $17 trillion investment. Now, needless to say, we're not remotely close to this. Now, nobody thinks that's going to be enough at this point in the scientific community. So the G8, again last summer, decided that we ought to aim for a 50% reduction below 2005 level by 2050. IEA indicated that that's a $45 trillion number, about $1.1 trillion a year, again using current dollars, to get there. And just if we're not close to 17 worldwide investment in R&D and implementation for new energy technologies, we're sure not close to 45. You know, these numbers may be off by a whole lot, but it does indicate the kind of scale that we're going to need to get to. So far I've talked about R&D, and you might conclude, well, let's just throw some R&D money at this. The problem is that the energy sector is a complex, established sector, and it is a much more complicated proposition to bring innovation to that kind of sector than it is in the kind of sector where we usually launch innovation. You know, why is that? It's because the U.S., in some ways, is a covered wagon technology culture. And what do I mean by that? We tend to launch innovation into open territory. Right? We tend to, you know, we living in a community, we get, you know, bored, frustrated. We decide to do something completely new. We get into a technology covered wagon. We go over the, you know, nearest mountain range and find new open territory and bring technology into that new open territory. That is the way we did IT. There was really nothing quite like computing or close to computing, you know, before we kind of launched the IT revolution. We don't tend to go back to established sectors and bring innovations to those. It's a much more complicated process. So, you know, we do a biotech revolution, but we don't go back and fix healthcare delivery, as the Hill is wrestling with now. We do, you know, thin film photovoltaics, but we don't go back and fix the grid. So we have a much more complicated problem with these in innovation, with these established complex sectors. It's much more like parachuting into occupied territory. And in some cases, the parachuters are going to get shot at. That's not the same as landing in an open territory with new innovation. So in a complex established sector, you've got a non-level playing field. The existing technologies are often heavily subsidized and politically powerful. And in effect, you've got a techno-economic political paradigm operating that creates certain barriers around these sectors, complicating the entry problem. And these sectors, these entrants have got to be price competitive immediately upon market introduction. That's a prerequisite, but that's not the only problem they face. Now, in my view, you know, elaborating what Rob said earlier, you know, I think we're going to need a cap and trade carbon price through cap and trade or carbon tax, because that's going to tend to solve that, move in the direction of that price entry problem. As Rob was also suggesting, that's a pretty high number. And it's going to be hard for the political process to reach that stage. But if we could get that number high enough, that would help in allowing new entrants to enter these fields. And I think it's going to be one of the requirements. There'll be regulatory, there will be price, but there will also be innovation requirements, as Rob suggested. We sort of have two innovation models that we work with in this country. We work with an induced innovation model where new entrants see pricing opportunities, they see pricing signals that allows them to do innovation and bring that into the marketplace. That's typically the way industry innovates, right? And these are principally for incremental technology advances. Now, we also have another, as you all know, innovation system that operates in parallel for radical innovation. And that is, we'll call it the, you know, pipeline model, where the federal government's R&D system plays a very significant role in helping, particularly on the research side. And then in some lucky cases, there's a handoff into the industry development side, or in some cases, government itself undertakes, particularly in the case of military, the development side as well. So we have these, that's the way we do technology. We have incremental technology advances, largely through an induced model, and we have kind of new radical breakthrough technology through the pipeline model. We're going to need both of these with a technology challenge as big as this one. Both of these are going to have to come to bear. It's not an either-or solution. It's not only pipeline, it's also induced. Now, I should say, too, that at least until this year, there's been, you know, real venture capital interest in the last few years in energy technology. But we should remember that that's really commercialization, right? That's not the earlier stage R&D side. For those technologies that are going to get venture capital support to be in range, they've got to be pretty darn close to market. So somehow we're going to have to get both these models working, the induced model and the pipeline model working, and then do a handoff to an enhanced venture capital system. But it's more complicated than that. What would a new energy technology program look like? How would it be organized? We've suggested a couple of ideas here, but let's try and dig to the next level. It's going to have to be very large in scale and scope. The problem with energy is the problem of scale. The scale is huge. This is a $1.5 trillion sector. It's, you know, in the same ballpark range as healthcare, right? It's a really huge part of our economy. And think about all the embedded infrastructure on the energy side, much of which will have to be altered or changed. It's going to have to be private sector led because these technologies are going to have to land in the private sector. This is not going to be the Apollo mission with a government contractor model. This is all going to have to land in an established set of energy markets. It should be, to the extent that we can do it, technology neutral. We really need to avoid technology lock-in here because we've got a 40-year project. And lots of new technology will evolve over that time period, and we've got to make sure there's room for the best stuff to enter and to evolve. And then I think that we're going to have to organize this really around, and this is what I'll dig into now, obstacles to the market launch. The traditional innovation pipeline model is worried about the valley of death, right? Between the earlier R&D stages and the late stage applied development kind of stage, right? And that's the gap that the literature is written around. But in a complex sector that's established like energy, I think we're going to need to focus not only on that valley of death stage, but an additional point, which is the moment of market launch. So let's look at some of the launch pathways by which the kind of energy technologies that we can see coming on now might get launched into that system. And if we can think about that, then maybe we can bring appropriate policy packages in to support those different launch pathways. And then, in addition, it's not only going to be support mechanisms, we're going to need new institutions here. We're going to need new innovation institutions because there's gaps in the existing system. We know that because we haven't been doing a whole lot in this territory in the last couple of decades. So let's think about where the gaps are and see what the institutional fixes might be on an organizational side to fill in those gaps. So a four-step process. Let's identify the ways of market launch. Let's identify the support packages that would help bring about that launch. Let's look at the gaps in the innovation system. And let's think about filling some of those gaps. So I'll quickly go through these four points. What are the market launch categories? Well, the first one is simple and straightforward. We know there's lots of experimental technologies out there. They're going to take a long time to evolve. Fine. We're going to need a lot of experimental technologies. And we don't have to worry so much about what the launch is going to look like. We can just keep throwing some R&D money at them to hope they get to a stage where they can advance. A second category, and we've been, a lot of the talk is around this category, are potentially disruptive innovations that can be launched into niche markets, drive their costs down, and expand into major markets. And you can think about solar photovoltaics that are off-grid and wind that's off-grid, or LEDs that are off-grid. LEDs are being launched in exactly this kind of way now. But the problem with energy is that we are going to have to land most of our new energy technologies as components or secondary technologies into established systems or platforms. So most of the stuff, particularly in the early decades, is going to have to land in, parachute into, these established technologies. So we're going to have at least a couple of kinds of these component technologies, we can categorize them, or secondary innovations, as they're sometimes called. There will be cases of these component innovations where the recipient system or the recipient platform is going to want them, right? They'd be happy to have them, as long as they come within price range. So batteries for plug-in hybrids. The auto industry probably wants to make plug-in hybrids, because, frankly, they're going to be better cars. Right? Car nuts will like these. Right? They're going to have better torque and acceleration. So, enhanced geothermal. Utilities, particularly in western states, would be pleased to have an additional source here if it can come into price range. But then there is the more complicated problem of contested launch. So there are industries, like the coal and utility sectors, that would be willing to do carbon capture and sequestration, but they're not just going to volunteer to add, you know, 25-30% to the price of retail price of delivered electricity just to be nice. They're going to have to be told to do this. You know, nuclear power has its own set of political challenges. Biofuels has a whole set of political challenges to enter into an established oil gasoline sector or a diesel sector. So there will be component innovations or secondary innovations they'll have to get that face inherent cost problems and political and non-market problems. They're going to have to get launched into established sectors. And that's going to be a different launch path than where they can be accepted. Then there's a couple more. There's some crossovers applied to existing technology, as well as these new technology categories we've been talking about. We're going to have to do a lot of end-use efficiency and conservation for everything. And these are where the early gains are. Huge potentially early gains, but you need to do this on a continuous ongoing basis for all evolving technologies. In addition, we're going to have a big problem driving the price down unless we have a much more concerted effort on manufacturing technology and manufacturing processes and the manufacturing scale-up process, right? You know, plug-in hybrids, great. You know, the Chevy Volt will make 10,000 copies in its first year. And then maybe in the second year of money returns to General Motors, they'll get to, you know, 40 or 50,000. And then a few, you know, next year, maybe they get to 120. When are they going to get to 4 million, right? You know, pretty soon we're all dead here by the time that scale-up occurs. And not only that, the fleet turnover of cars is at this point, probably over 15 years, right? So you can begin to think about the length of time that these technology shifts are going to take, even in sectors where we have a perfect glimpse of what it's going to be. So manufacturing scale-up becomes a very important element, potentially, in getting this thing done. So we've talked about six launch categories. Then what are we supposed to do? I won't go into a lot of detail here, but there will need to be federal policies in support of these. So on the front end, you're going to have R&D and demonstrations and prototyping support. That goes for everything. All of these technologies and all those six categories are going to need this. That's traditional. It's not too hard politically to do. We just never do it at scale. On the back end side, we're going to need some carrots, right? So you can think about these secondary or component technologies where the industry will take them if they can come in a price range, right? So, you know, the whole bundle of support packages running from loan guarantees to price guarantees to tax credits for new energy to government procurement programs and new product buy-down programs and that kind of range of incentive carrot stuff will be relevant here. A lot of important work needs to be done in figuring out the relative economic efficiencies of these different approaches, because we haven't done that yet. And not all these tools will work for all six categories. Loan guarantees will work for nuclear. Are they really going to work for, you know, off-grid solar photovoltaics? No. Right? So we'll have to think about what the optimal packages are. And then, in the case of those component technologies, they're going to have a contested launch, right? The industry is going to have to be told, do this, right? Otherwise, they won't be able to. Those are going to need standards or regulatory requirements, renewable portfolio standards, for example, emissions taxes. You know the menu, what this menu looks like. Now, I should say, too, that if you get a strong carbon price, what you have to do on the back end, i.e. the carrots and the sticks, is considerably less than what you might have to do if those weren't in place. And we need, as I said before, work on the best tools for the different technology categories. All right, so step one, figure out what the market launch ways are going to be and try and categorize them and then try and fit policies that make those work. Step three is, let's look at the innovation system. You know, innovation is a system, right? It is an organized system with players. And how are those players working together? it's not going to be enough to have the financing tools and the R&D tools in place. We're going to have to think about the way in which we organize this process as well. Some of the gaps that Chuck Weiss and I in our book have thought about include our difficulty in doing translational research. To take the Department of Energy example, in taking some of the terrific science that's coming out of the Office of Science and then moving that to the applied technology agencies in DOE like ERE or fossil or nuclear. How are we going to better improve that handoff? So Secretary Chu, the Gathering Storm Report, recommended an ARPA-E thing, model, not a DARPA model, which occupies exactly that kind of territory in the Defense Department. Right? Maybe that model is applicable here. So hence the ARPA-E proposal. And there's other things it could do, which is to speed up the scaling of manufacturing. It could speed up, it could do the R&D on the manufacturing process and technology side, as DARPA has indeed done on the defense side on many occasions. Another piece, a wholly owned government corporation, to do those back-end financing elements that we were talking about before. You know, in effect, this is like a bank. There are provisions like this now in both the House and Senate energy bills that are pending. Congress sees this dilemma, as does industry. We'll need help doing very carefully monitored demonstrations of large-scale engineering projects, traditionally very hard for a government agency to manage because they don't have the financing strength and typically they don't have the sort of commercial engineering capability. We could speed the scale-up of manufacturing production through this kind of financing entity. We could speed the installation of conservation and efficiency, for example, in residential or small-scale commercial buildings, if we had a financing mechanism in place. So maybe we need this kind of bank-like government corporation. Let's try and get it. I think we'll need to get it out of the hands of the appropriations process into as close as we can get to the private sector. Obviously, this proposal is not without controversy, given our current financing crisis and problems with places like Fannie Mae, but I think we're going to need this piece. Third, we're going to need a think tank to develop a pretty detailed strategy and a roadmap. We're going to need to get to a real technology strategy, not just a list of stuff we're doing, right? But it's going to have a lot of private sector leadership because this stuff is going to have to land there. Not just public sector leadership or academic leadership, although those parties will have to be deeply involved. So those are some gaps. There's many more. And Dan, for example, has thought about a whole different additional agenda in this territory that we'll talk about, I hope. You know, this is not probably the toughest technology problem per se the country has faced. This is, I think, the toughest technology implementation problem that we face. So where's the administration, just very quickly? You know, the president has articulated a picture here of innovation-based economic growth. And he's argued that during the campaign, he's argued it in his National Academy speech, he's argued it on many occasions. You know, this is a structural recession. We're not going to get out of it just by a traditional business cycle evolution. We've lost a lot of jobs. They're going to be permanently lost. We are going to have to find a way of creating new jobs. The administration, the president, articulated that, hey, this is not a bad potential growth sector. This is a lot of stuff is within range that we can actually do. Could this be a next technology revolution and put a whole economic growth element in this territory, introduce a new, to use a phrase Rob knows a lot about, new innovation wave. Where are we? RPE is now funded. It's being stood up. Financing bank is in both energy bills in the Senate. We don't have a technology strategy. Maybe we could get there. But the administration hasn't really focused yet on organizing the details of a strategy or how they're going to bring about this clean energy revolution. We have a problem in Congress, which is that the cap and trade bill really did not use the revenues that are potentially available to fund the technology revolution we're going to need here. So there's an open question now as to whether the Senate bill will try and take that step. Without that, I don't know where the funding comes from to get to the scale that we need to get to on the innovation side. You know, President Obama has said we can seed the race of the 21st century, or we can embrace the reality that our competitors already have. The nation that leads the world in creating a new clean energy economy will be the nation that leads the 21st century global economy. How are we doing? Well, China, for example, looks like, according to Acor, has launched a $400 billion 10-year clean energy technology program. Korea has announced that it's going to spend no less than 2% of its GDP on clean energy technology. For any country, that's a huge number. For Korea, that's $84 billion over the next 5 years. Right? India is making similar targets for new energy technologies that the other countries are attempting. We're not close to any of those kinds of investment levels. So even though the United States has led investment and has led innovation ways for the last century and a half, this one is very much up in the air. This one's very much up for grabs. At the moment, I would say we're not going to lead this technology revolution unless something changes. The administration needs an innovation strategy for energy. It needs to move that towards a roadmap. It needs an energy technology manufacturing strategy. In particular, it's going to have to think about an energy technology funding strategy, which it hasn't faced yet. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. I'd also note that both of the slide presentations will be up on our website if you want to, so you don't take too detailed the notes.
Okay. Thanks, Rob and Bill, for allowing me to crash the party. And also want to acknowledge two colleagues here, John Alec and Claudia Nirenberg, who just disappeared into the back. And when it comes time to questions, and I'll try to blow through my talk quickly so we can have a lot of time for questions. When you ask difficult ones, I'm going to look at John beseechingly, since Rob talked about people with innovation expertise, and John is peerless in this regard. So there's a famous joke about a contest where the first prize is a day in Philadelphia, and the second prize is 2 days in Philadelphia. And so I'm the second prize. You get to hear a presentation similar to Bill's, although there will be different emphases, but probably not as compelling. I think the key point here, and this is something that Rob and Bill and I were kind of vociferously complaining about prior to this presentation, to this briefing, is that innovation is simply not being taken sufficiently seriously as the core of the climate mitigation problem. And until we take it sufficiently seriously, and there's lots of ways to think about it, we are not going to really be able to get our heads around or our actions around what needs to be done to drive the energy system in the direction that it needs to go. So I'm going to report on a project that we're just on the verge of completing. There's a one-page description of the report that's coming out, and the report will be out in about a month. You can get a pre-publication sort of embargoed version off of a web address that's on this one-pager if you're interested. And I think it's a nice complement to Bill and Chuck's book, which, by the way, is as Rob said, short, a good read, and a really great introduction to the set of issues. So this is a project that was conducted by my organization as well as the Clean Air Task Force, a little NGO out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and funded by the National Commission on Energy Policy. And we've done this over the last 6 months, which is amazingly fast for an academic-based project. And the idea was, we know a lot about how innovation works and about innovation policy. And there's a lot of very important experience to the lessons from which can be applied to the energy problem. And we're not taking that seriously. And so the idea of this project was to really, was to look at what we've learned from innovation, U.S. innovation policy, especially since World War II, and think about how that can be applied to the energy problem. And the idea here, similar to the kinds of recommendations that Bill made, but maybe in a more general way, was to provide guidelines and recommendations that could be used as tests or as lenses to look at a variety of more concrete policy proposals to see if they're really driving the system in the way that it needs to be driven towards a much more rapid energy innovation. So the rationale for this is all pretty familiar, the rationale for the project is, first, we're simply not on a path to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I will just place an empirical embarrassment in front of you, which is that we've been focused on climate change significantly for the last 20 years, politically, diplomatically, scientifically. We've made no progress. Okay. Now you can say, well, we have international agreements, we have a climate bill that's on the verge of being passed, other countries are taking the issue seriously, emissions are not going down, emissions continue to rise, and not only that, the rising emissions are continuing to accelerate. So this is a problem we've not yet been able to get our heads and hands around. The second, obviously, is we simply don't have the commercially viable technology that we need to deal with the problem. And so this is the essence of the issue. It's an essence that has not really been fully appreciated, and it's one that that today's briefing is really all about. The third that I've already mentioned is we know a lot about innovation. We're not applying these lessons to the energy problem, and we need to do so, and we need to do so assertively and aggressively starting now. And then a third is that government has been an extremely important part of innovation policy in the U.S., for the last 60 years, actually for the last 100 years, but particularly in terms of driving both economic growth and technological innovation. The role of government policy has been crucial, and we need to really get that right. So here are some of the challenges that have to be met, and these are just different ways of saying what Bill has already said. The first is that the energy system is incredibly complicated, too complicated to be understood and too complicated to be managed, okay? We can't just look at it and say, well, we'll tweak this here and tweak this there and we will get the system to evolve in the right way. No one can understand it. It is a thicket of regulations, of different types of knowledge, of institutions, of interests, of public attitudes that make management of the system towards a particular goal, that is reduction of CO2 emissions, extraordinarily complicated and difficult. A related issue that makes it so difficult, again, Bill talked about this, is that there's really no reason for the system to change of its own accord simply because it's pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at 60 billion tons a year. Maybe off by three orders of magnitude there. And part of the problem is you don't care where your electrons come from, right? They're just electrons. It's a commodity. And so the idea that a more expensive but less carbon emitting source of electrons is beneficial is one that's very, very difficult to actually rationalize within the marketplace or the innovation system. Again, carbon prices, hard to imagine that carbon coal is, there's just a lot of it and it's cheap. Oil is relatively cheap too. It's very difficult to imagine any kind of politically feasible path to get carbon prices down to a level that would really, really drive changes in consumption and in innovation without a significant focus on the innovation process itself. And then finally, the U.S. innovation policy, again, Bill's talked about the effect of disinvestment in innovation policy for, related to energy. DOE has not been focused on this problem. No one's really been focused on this problem. So we need to redesign the national innovation system and national innovation policy related to energy. So these are huge, huge tasks and challenges. So as I said, in our project, one of the things we wanted to do was to focus on learning from past examples. And the project was in part literature search and trying to cull what we knew, what we've known from successes in the past and failures in the past, as well as we looked at three particular cases that were intended to illustrate different aspects of the technological innovation challenge. We looked at photovoltaic cells. We had a workshop on that. We looked at post-combustion capture of carbon at coal plants, because coal plants are a huge proportion of the problem. And if we don't get emissions from coal plants under control in the next in the coming decades, we will have no real prospect for getting the carbon emissions problem under control as well. So, and then there's a third kind of outside the box technology. We looked at air capture of carbon. These are technologies similar to the post-combustion technologies that would simply extract carbon dioxide directly from the atmosphere. And what's interesting about that is, first of all, obviously, it's very, even though it's theoretically and even sort of as an engineering problem, it's well demonstrated. It's very much out there as a frontier technology, but it's also outside of the energy system. So you could implement air capture of carbon without having to change the entire energy system itself. But of course, it also is simply a cost, right? It doesn't provide anything except the long-term benefits of reduced CO2 emissions. So some of the things we looked at in trying to develop lessons for the current problem of energy technology innovations, we looked at nuclear power. A couple of important points on nuclear power is, first of all, I mean, in thinking about all the energy technology revolution that we're going to need, I think we all agree that we're going to need it. If you look back on the last 50 or 60 years, nukes are really the only significant, that is, large-scale, major new type of technology. And this gets to this problem of a very embedded system with technologies that have constituencies, have infrastructure around them, very difficult to introduce new types of technologies. Not only that, huge amount of government money poured into it. To make it plausible, to bring the private sector on board. So there was that on the kind of plus side. On the minus side, it was rushed into very quickly without adequate demonstration of alternative technologies. That led to it not only led to things like Three Mile Island, but it also led to very slow increases in reliability. Right now, nuclear power is extraordinarily reliable, but it really took 30 years of getting to that level through a lot of learning that could have been done early on through a more concerted series of demonstration projects and a more a healthier relationship between the government and the private sector in bringing on and experimenting with new technologies. Another example that's often analogized to what we need is information technology. Of course, there's a lot of differences between information technology and the infotech revolution and energy. For example, you're not going to see anything like Moore's Law for energy. Moore's Law is not really a law, it's simply an observation, a self-fulfilling prophecy that computer power increases every 18 months or so. Thermodynamics tells you that there can only be so much efficiency gotten out of the process of creating energy from fuel sources, and that will never particularly approach 100%. But the idea of a continual doubling, say, of performance is never going to happen in energy. This is more going to be asymptotic. We're going to increase efficiency slowly, continually, incrementally, but we're not going to see the sorts of radical increases over short amount of time that you see with infotech. Another thing about infotech that makes it different from energy technologies is all the things that we now are completely dependent on are novel technologies that didn't replace anything before. So when the iPod suddenly appeared or a cell phone suddenly appeared, these had new applications that were appealing to people and could create new kinds of markets. But again, this is all the energy innovation problem is all about electrons, and electrons are electrons. So this idea of novel applications is that can drive markets is much less operational in the problem of energy technology innovation. Other points that can be analogized, a crucial government role in R&D and purchasing, the idea that the IT revolution emerged in garages in Stanford, in Palo Alto, California, and places like that. It's only true to the extent that you realize that those garages were hugely subsidized by the Department of Defense and were strongly supported by professors at places like Stanford and MIT. So government role is very important. Customers, there were very important customers, and this is a point I'll come back to a couple more times, especially the Department of Defense, right? And this is something we don't see with energy. The Department of Energy, which has responsibility for energy technology and energy innovation, is not a customer for energy technology and energy innovation particularly. So it does not impose a level of accountability on the technologies that it is trying to improve, and that's a very important difference. Whereas DOD was continually demanding of innovation in information tech to do things like allow it to build more effective missile systems, missile guidance systems, computer networking, etc. Finally, Infotech had a very significant diversification in terms of the private sector's role, and that allowed much more competition to go on in the private sector than occurs in energy right now. So another point to be made is just the scale of the innovation activity for energy right now is very, very small compared to what we're going to need and compared to what we saw for things like IT. Two other examples. This speaks to the issue of breakthroughs. So it's a word that's used a lot. We're going to need to have an energy revolution. We're going to need new sorts of technologies. Breakthroughs don't come along very often. They're very unpredictable, very difficult to engineer. And much of what's going to have to happen to really create the initial conditions for an energy technology innovation system that gets us where we need to be is going to have to happen with technologies that are now in sight. Okay, that are not the kinds of things we'd necessarily call breakthroughs. An example is high temperature superconductors discovered in the mid-1980s. Lots of fanfare, lots of congressional attention. Still no significant commercial applications. And this just and there may someday be, or there may never be. But this is the kind of thing that was predicted as revolutionary for the energy system because it would allow zero resistance transmission of electricity, which would be something that could hugely increase efficiency. 20 years later, not there yet. And this is the way it typically goes with breakthroughs. So that you have to think in two different ways about the energy innovation problem. There is the problem of how do you keep the idea of new breakthroughs alive, but that's only going to speak to 2 to 3 to 4 decades in the future. It's the kind of stuff you can't predict. And then there's how do you really rapidly accelerate incremental innovation of the technologies that are already in view. The three cases that we looked at, photovoltaics, post-combustion capture of carbon, and air capture, just a couple of things that shared by these two and that surprised us. And the first is that it's not about basic research for any of these. Okay, even something as sort of frontier-oriented, as wild and wacky-sounding as air capture might be, it's not about basic research. It's about taking things that already work and making them better incrementally. It's about demonstration projects that can create confidence in the private sector, and it's about throwing money at them. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And again, government role in each of these is crucial. There is no energy technology that has ever advanced significantly without a significant role of the government in making that possible. And that's going to be the case for all future energy technologies for reasons that I hope have become clear. So our conclusions, briefly. First, some principles for thinking about what energy innovation is going to have to look like if we're going to succeed. And this is complementary to all the things that Bill has said, though with some slightly different emphases. First, again, this point that's a complex system. That means it can't be managed for particular outcomes. So that we have to have a system that focuses on exploring multiple paths simultaneously because we don't know what's going to work when. This gets to Bill's point about you want to avoid premature lock-in of particular technologies. The second is that in the next 10 to 20 years, it's not going to be about breakthroughs. It's going to be about getting a lot better at the technologies that we already have at our disposal, everything from plug-in hybrids to air capture of carbon. The third is that, and this is a framing issue, and I think it's potentially a very novel way to rethink this problem in terms of how do you justify the government role. But we're not talking about a decarbonized energy system as a public good, but that's exactly what it is. Just as no one asks how much is national defense worth, or how much is individual and community health and safety worth, or protection from natural disasters. Obviously, there are practical limits to how much we can spend on these things, but we don't talk about what is it really worth to protect San Francisco from being destroyed in an earthquake? We accept that as something that's the role of the government. We accept national defense as something the role of the government automatically to provide. It's a public good, and that's a kind of framing that could be applied to energy technology innovation to decarbonize the energy system, and that has very specific implications for what kinds of interventions are then suddenly in the game that I'll mention in a minute. And then finally, this is the same point that Bill ended with, the right policies have to be contextually sensitive. There's not one policy for all energy technologies. There need to be appropriate technologies. The ones for photovoltaic cells are very different from the ones for post-combustion capture of carbon. Nevertheless, government role is crucial, and the portfolio of policies that are available to us very well understood, and we can easily choose the appropriate ones. Okay, the recommendations. The first is that there's simply not enough competition within the government over energy programs. This is all at DOE. As I mentioned, DOE is not incentivized to be an appropriate customer. And the other thing is, because DOE doesn't have a competition within government, it also is not incentivized to perform particularly well. And it turns out that there's many other agencies in the government who could do things that are relevant to energy innovation. And I'll talk a little bit more about DOD in a minute, but the Department of Treasury, for example, one talks about loan guarantees. DOE has had some trouble putting their loan guarantee systems into place. There are other places that have expertise. Army Corps of Engineer has expertise in developing infrastructure systems. One could think of this as an infrastructure type system. And the Department of Defense, of course, has huge expertise in ratcheting up innovation in high-tech systems. And so these are the sorts of things that would add significantly to the capability of the government to accelerate energy technology innovation, and that would also, importantly, incentivize DOE to improve its own performance. So this is kind of a complex system approach in that it doesn't choose a particular intervention point. It rather focuses on a way to think about the system as a whole that can incentivize improved performance. Second recommendation is that this is the importance of this issue of demonstration and scale-up. Okay, especially for technologies like post-combustion capture and air capture, where there's really no market rationale. Okay, this is something that we're just going to have to pay for and do. And if you want to create confidence that these things can work, then you're going to have to do significant. There have to be significant commitments to demonstration projects, and also very importantly, that this requires really effective collaboration between the government and the private sector, because the private sector knows how to do demonstrations. And this kind of expertise will be necessary to ensure that the sorts of demonstrations that we're going to need to do for things like post-combustion capture are effective. Similarly, in terms of competition with DOE, Department of Defense also, you know, most of its budget is on the D end of R&D, and demonstration is a big part of the development end of things. So DOD, again, on this demonstration phase could be a very important player. Third, this is the sort of the operational complement of the public good argument, is that we could think of this as a sort of a public works approach to implementation. So just as the government played a crucial role in everything from building canals to sewers to rural electrification to dams to natural hazard mitigation, a public works approach to energy innovation would create the idea of government as significant customer, and that's going to be the next point that I want to make. So that the government as significant the public works argument is the rationale, okay? And there's a 200-year sort of history of government role in public works as a contributor to quality of life, as a rationale for government investment in energy R&D, in energy innovation. And if you think about who is going to be the customer, which is a sort of embarrassingly neglected question, who's going to buy all this stuff, right? Who is going to incentivize private sector to become involved because they know that there's markets out there? Well, this is a role that the government has centrally played in the last 50 or 60 years with every major technology system that we've now come to depend on. So the idea of government as large-scale purchaser and guarantor of emerging technologies, and also, to be frank, you know, this is a way to allow one to evade a bit the relentless logic of the marketplace. If the Department of Defense is committed to ratcheting down its carbon footprint via technological innovation, it can focus more on performance initially than on price, which is something that the Department of Defense has long done. That can lead to creation of significant confidence in the private sector, which creates more innovation, more competition in the private sector that then spins off into markets other than the federal market. So it seems to us that a crucial next step is to recognize the government as a important catalyst for energy innovation simply via its power as a consumer and its power as a customer. And this is going to mean direct expenditures. And I think that we're going to have to face that, that this all can't be done through the magic of markets and of allowances. Some of this is going to have to be done through significant direct investment in the technologies itself. Until we get to that point, I think we're not going to really be serious about energy technology innovation. Okay, thanks very much. As I said, this report will be released in mid-August, but if you want to get a sneak preview of it, you can find it at that rather overlong URL, and it's also listed on the back of this one-page summary. Thanks very much.
Great, thank you, Dan. We've got about 20 minutes for discussion. I just wanted to make one quick point. Both Dan and Bill alluded to the issue that we've got a multiplicity of paths that we have to go down, and one of them is efficiency. I think it's important to recognize, given that we're ITIF, that IT is going to drive a lot of those efficiencies. We wrote a report called Digital Quality of Life. There's a whole chapter in there. It's on our website on the role of IT in driving efficiency. For example, when you buy a book on Amazon, or actually you don't even buy a book on Amazon anymore, you get it delivered directly to your Kindle. So we'll use that example. But just simply buying a book on Amazon, having it delivered to your house, is about four times more energy efficient than what the alternative would be, which is going to the mall and getting it directly to your Kindle, is probably 20 times more efficient. So unless it's 1984, in which case then you can go and buy the book. So just want to identify yourself. Raise your hand. Identify yourself, Phil.
Philip Weber, Congressional Budget Office. These were interesting presentations, but my thought is that energy policy isn't new. Some of us have been away from it for a while, but we've coming back to it. And other than Dr. Sarowitz's discussion of what we learned from nukes, I see no history in either of these presentations. I mean, we've tried to bring the cost of energy technologies down before. We've spent billions of dollars on that stuff, and yet the technology costs came down, but as people have studied this stuff, this is not new. The costs come down, but energy prices came down even more. So none of the energy technologies, or rather they have taken off very, very slowly. What I don't see in any of these presentations is this lesson. What did we learn? And my entire professional career has been since 1973, and I'm on the verge of retirement. So let's have some history.
You can do it from here, Bill.
Okay.
Yeah. Unless you want to come up.
You know, actually, so if you want to read the book, there's actually a fair amount of history in there. But, you know, let's look at that history for a second, right? Our strategy has been underfunded R&D, right? That's essentially been the heart of the thrust in development of these new energy technologies. And, you know, we saw the curves, right, as high point in 1980 and then a declining pattern following that. Obviously, there's been a recent, you know, increase in investment on the federal side through the stimulus bill, with close to $40 billion going mostly into technology implementation, but $5 billion and change into the R&D side. But we have, what I think I've tried to argue, and Chuck Weiss and I try and argue in this book, is that a standalone R&D strategy is not enough here, right? Because we're not landing in a new sector, right? We're landing in a complex established sector. And therefore, a whole additional set of steps have to get thought about, because innovation in a complex established sector is a different proposition than innovation in new territory. You know, I've been a student of the innovation literature, you know, off and on for the last, you know, 15 years or so of my career. It is an innovation literature that is focused on that new territory problem. It is focused on that valley of death, how to get across that valley of death problem, right? It is not a literature that has seriously looked at innovation in a complex established sector. So that's kind of what Dan and I are trying to say, is that we have to develop a different set of models if we're going to innovate in a complex established sector, and the history is proof, right? The history of essentially attempting R&D investment with a few early demonstration phases that, you know, were not continued in the 79-80 time period, that's not going to work. And it's got to be multidimensional here. So unless we think about price, regulation, technology implementation, the development phase as well as the research phase, unless we think about all of these, we're going to be missing a lot of pieces. So there is a rich history here. It's a painful history. This is, you know, the effort towards, quote, American energy independence has been an announced political mantra for four decades. And it probably amounts to the largest political failure in U.S. political history. It is not pretty to look at, and I think they would agree that a large part of the problem is that we have not attempted to develop a really thorough and deep look at the system we're trying to innovate within and develop a real systems approach to it. Dan?
Let me just add two quick things. One is, in some sense, the whole sad history you're alluding to is not alluding to, or explicitly addressing, is embodied in this point of electrons as being a commodity, and if coal is cheap, it's a difficult problem to deal with through standard approaches. And so I guess what I'd say is our focus on this idea of public works, public goods, plus, you know, the government is going to have to be a consumer, is an answer to the historical conundrum of why all this talk has never gotten us anywhere. So in fact, our approach is very historically oriented, but not at looking at so much at energy, the history of energy technology innovation, because we think we understand why that hasn't been able to succeed. It's what are the successes? What are the successes in other domains of innovation tell us? And one thing they tell us is, if the government is not a significant, reliable customer and demanding customer, we're probably not going to be able to jumpstart the markets that in ways that are going to be necessary, and that problem is amplified because of this commodity-like nature of electricity.
Chris, and then
yeah, thank you. I think the
Chris wanted that first.
Yeah, Chris Gang with Mercator 21. I think the discussion this morning has been great, and you've really framed a lot of the tension points and the opportunity points. But what I took from this, listening to you both, was that yes, government has a role to play. Yes, innovation comes in two flavors fundamentally: breakthroughs and then incremental breakthroughs, technology breakthroughs, incremental breakthroughs over time. Bill's point about we've got to work on the incremental breakthroughs initially if we want to get some traction here. I'd have two suggestions. One is, fundamentally, we see innovation affecting economic growth and trajectory around two things: either a disruptive technology or a disruptive business model. Right? And the role government can play, Dan, to your point, as a purchaser, it doesn't seem to focus on purchasing disruptive models. It seems to focus on purchasing disruptive technologies. And Bill, whether it's your new government organization that you want to be as a banker or whatever that government-sponsored organization is, I think we would be well served if that and government as a purchaser focused on the disruptive business model of energy sources and alternatives rather than just the new breakthrough, because you'll be able to get some much faster return, I think. I mean, if you look at the iPod, it was not a disruptive technology. It was a disruptive business model, right? It accelerated the market for online entertainment and online content sharing. It was in no way a disruptive technology. It was a disruptive business model. And I think the degree to which we could take that approach to this area, because I do agree with you, it's a very mature sector you're trying to innovate into, you're going to have to change the business models and make them better.
Why don't we try to keep the answers very brief, because we know we've got a bunch of people with questions. So maybe just one person answer that one. And
yes, good idea.
That's real brief. Great. Good insight, Chris.
We're just trying to help out.
That's a good point. Tina. Do you want to identify yourself?
Oh, sorry. Tina Carlsberg. I'm with the U.S. Department of Energy. I think I'm commenting mostly on Dan's, but maybe Billy. Whoever talked about the nuclear, somebody said it was the sole example. And I believe that actually natural gas is another good example of a major source in plus and minus ways, because we weren't allowed to use natural gas for a while to generate power. But the technology that really ended up taking off was a DOD inspired technology from aircraft, which is sort of another example of DOD getting into that. So I think that actually makes the case you were trying to make about the advantages of getting someone, I guess the private sector figured out that these gas turbines would make good power generator turbines. There was some irrational exuberance in that sector, but I think that might be a good model to explore if you want to respond. And then just another thing on the nuclear, your first point about nuclear was that we went into it too quickly, but it seems to me that for climate change, we need to move extremely quickly. So what is the, was it that we moved too quickly the wrong way, or was it, or is the only solution to move less quickly, which seems to be not what we want to do now? That's all.
Okay, so briefly, I mean, we moved too quickly in a way that locked us into one particular path, rather than maximizing design options early on. And so that led us to down a path that made it difficult to achieve rapid performance increases. So sometimes you need to think before you leap. But that's not to disagree with your point that quickness is important, but smart quickness rather than dumb quickness. I agree on the jet engine point. It's in the report, in fact. And I don't know if John wants to say anything more about it, but I think you're absolutely right.
Prakash Ambegaonkar from Bridging Nations. You know, Bill, this presentation, of course, is very, very good. But what I felt is that, and we talked a little bit through your book, is that we're looking at innovation, especially in the energy, as a national problem. And we all know that climate change and the energy is a global problem. To what extent can we think of innovation in a globalized manner? On the one hand, innovation is a competitive advantage, and every nation will try to protect that competitive advantage. But are we coming to a point in this particular space that absolutely there is no choice but to do shared innovation? And that may involve a lot of strong structural changes, maybe. If the nuclear suppliers group can control the trade, so similarly, can we not think of a situation where in some informal fashion, at least, that the nations will try to do innovation jointly. And we have examples of the past that this was one. Otherwise, I do not know how we're going to get out of this. Just this morning, the news came out that when Hillary Clinton was visiting India, they both totally opposite of the climate change thing. And then it based on the previous perceptions and the whole old model of thinking. So it's a way to look at it something differently, or if we can't, then are we willing, if the United States policy, are we willing, would we be winning this innovation race?
Bill, and Andrew.
Sure. Maybe I can start off, Dan. Prakash, I think you're absolutely right that even if the United States reorganized its innovation system to tackle this problem, that doesn't come close to dealing with the problem. So it truly is a global problem, and innovation problems have not been dealt with historically, except through the nation state. So we lack a lot of elements to be able to tackle this. But let's try and break the problem down a bit. And there's a chapter in the book on this. On the development deployment side, you know, we truly have globalized firms that operate around the world, and they're pretty good. You know, if you can get a technology within range, you know, you can find a within range and price range, right? You can find a way to get this thing deployed. So, you know, I think that the D and deployment side get dealt with by the globalization of the economy to a significant extent. The issue is I think therefore more on the R research side and the complexities of that. Now, I think as a fundamental rule here, you know, we want Adam Smith capitalism and a pressure for competition to prevail here. So let's not put barriers in the way of innovative companies from coming up with, you know, interesting new technology solutions. Let's make sure they thrive, right? But on the other hand, there's got to be a certain kind of consciousness, and let me describe one particular problem as a way of thinking about this with you. MIT recently put out a report a couple weeks ago on retrofitting coal-fired power plants. So, you know, as Dan noted, coal-fired power plants are a huge part of the problem. It's like 15% of the problem now. The United States has, you know, somewhere in the range of 300 coal-fired power plants. China is probably approaching 400 million. China's going to add another 400 million 6-7 years after that, probably another 400 million 6-7 years out of that. This is going to be a growing problem. Okay, so our technology R&D focus to date has been, oh, we'll never figure out how to re-engineer existing coal-fired power plants. It's not economically efficient. We'll just build new ones. Well, the reality is we're going to have a slew of old ones, right, in place, and we're going to have to wrestle with this. So there is a, you know, big technology problem that is at hand. Now, we kind of know generally how we would do this from a technology science standpoint. But the real technology problem is driving this price down, because if we can't, China's just not going to do this unless the capture price can get driven, you know, probably well below $20 a ton. And we don't have technologies at the moment that will come close to that. So there's a big technology challenge in radically improving the efficiency. Different coal-fired power plants will be in different stages of financing, the ones that are already financed, and sort of through that, you know, funding process may be more eligible for a lot of re-engineering. But this is a technology problem we haven't spent a lot of time thinking about. It happens to be a deeply shared problem across many countries, including China and India. You know, maybe this is an opportunity for a little collaborative work here in what is a highly regulated sector in all three countries. So there are going to be exceptions to the Adam Smith rule where collaboration will make sense for the participants. And you can begin to see situations where some bilateral collaboration would make a firm in a sense as well. Not necessarily multitudes of nations, but opportunities for collaborative R&D across national boundaries. Again, each country has pretty much organized the research stage around a national innovation model. So amongst the many models that we're going to have to think about in this process of dealing with this complex system, you know, this is one of them.
We have time for one more question, which is right here.
I didn't give you a chance to. Okay.
Scott Cooper, American National Standards Institute. A lot of the words you all have been using are very familiar to us. Sort of collaboration, consensus, public-private, I think, is the one that is certainly has a lot of cachet right now. But it's been hard to define that. And most of the examples we've had are kind of one-off examples where we put together a consortium, we put together some sort of quickly designed kind of collaboration between the public sector and the private sector to meet one particular need. I think what we're talking about here, though, is clearly that we're going to have to come up with a model that is going to be very much more fungible and is going to cross a lot of these lines. And what hit me, I think, was the answer to the previous question on sort of international collaboration, hopefully public-private in there as well. The example I'd use is something that's very prosaic. It's cook stoves. You know, in almost a billion homes around the world, they're using very, very inefficient cook stoves or no cook stoves at all. And we found that that's actually the second largest problem with global warming is poorly combusted soot coming from these, you know, almost billion cook stoves in developing countries. A good cook stove costs between $15 and $20. But a bad cook stove looks just like a good one. And so Gresham's Law applies here. They drive the good ones out. We really need something like a public-private partnership in this area that's global to be able to bring people together. We've talked to the World Bank. We've talked to EPA over 2 years now. but getting everybody to kind of agree about how to move forward. We know what the model should look like. We know what we need to do for conformance, but getting everybody to actually come together on something relatively inexpensive as this, and something that clearly everybody's recognized as being a huge problem. If we can't come up with public-private solutions on areas like this, I think it's going to be very hard to move forward on these other issues that are going to be much more expensive, and fill in areas where there's already momentum by existing groups to go on doing what they're doing. So I'd love to get ideas sort of percolating about how do we actually put together public-private partnerships on this.
Quick answer, because we're almost run out.
I guess the only thing I'd say is I don't think all public-private partnerships will be the same. I mean, obviously, they're going to have to be incentivized to develop appropriately. I mean, the Cookstove problem seems more like eradication of smallpox than it does retrofitting coal-fired power plants. So, I think this simply speaks to the point that the policies are going to have to be contextually appropriate to the technologies, which doesn't answer your question. It simply reinforces your point that we do have to, we've got to get the policies right, and it's not going to be one size fits all, and it's going to take significant focused resources. But I'm, the money's not the only thing. The cultural and logistical issues involved with something like that. I mean, think about bed nets, right? So very, very difficult. And in fact, it may turn out that coal-fired power plants are easier to deal with simply because we're just talking about an N of a couple of thousand. So that raises another question about, how are you going to prioritize? And it may turn out that even though that seems like the more sensible one, it may be a much harder nut to crack than something that you can have a smaller N on. So.
Great. I think in many ways, these are issues of implementation. And once we get our heads around the fact that we have to do innovation, really smart people, as many of you are involved in this issue, we'll figure these questions out. To me, the biggest issue is we've got to come to the realization that innovation is the real answer here and then start to make progress around that. So I think we made progress today on that point, so please join me in welcoming two great speakers.